I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. The UN agency that looks after refugees announced last week that 350,000 African refugees went home last year. That's people returning to countries like Uganda and Sierra Leone after years of civil war. However, 4 million people in Africa remain displaced. The UN High Commission for Refugees expects to spend over $1 billion this coming year caring for these people and others across Asia and Europe and in the Middle East. In many ways, the work of the agency is the essence of the UN mission, caring for those who have nothing. No one would argue with the fact that this UN agency has saved millions of lives. And yet the work of the UNHCR is also at the heart of controversy over what the UN has become. Critics say the agency allows nations to pay a kind of blood money in exchange for warehousing refugees. And as long as those people are sheltered and clothed, countries like this one and others then forget about them. So this hour, we're looking back at the refugee stories of the last decade and trying to figure out what we can learn. We'll hear two sides of the story, one from the woman who led the UNHCR, Sadako Ogata, and the other from the writer David Reif. We also want to hear from you. What do you think is the best way to help refugees? Does the UN need to do the work that wealthy countries will not? Should the UN work with large, powerful nations to get its job done, or is that what gets it in trouble and erodes its credibility? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I have with me in the Connection studio the woman who headed the UNHCR for the longest period in its history. Sadako Ogata was the UN's High Commissioner for Refugees from 1991 all the way to 2000. She has a book about those years now out. It's called The Turbulent Decade. David Reif is joining us from a studio in New York. He spent a lot of time in war zones as a writer and a reporter. His latest book is At the Point of a Gun, Democratic Dreams and Armed Intervention. You two both know each other. It's a pleasure to have both of you with me here on The Connection.
Thank you.
Hi, how are you?
I'm very well. I want to begin, if I can, Mrs. Ogata, with a story that you tell in your book about your very first week on the job.
Oh, I see. Yes, it's a long time ago. But I went to the job without realizing what I was to face. This is a lot of new wars, in a way, mostly internal wars. But the first experience was a lot of emergencies to come. And a different kind of emergencies.
Yours was supposed to be a tenure when we saw the world healing itself from
the Cold War, yes. And I thought I would be going in much, much more for solutions, because the Cold War had produced refugees caused by East-West confrontation. And there was very little feeling that there were solutions possible. Cold War was it. Once you had to flee from the Eastern countries, communist countries, you could not go back.
So February 1991, first week in the job in Geneva, and all of a sudden you have Kurds in the mountains mm-hmm. in southern Turkey. You have
Northern Turkey. Southern Turkey,
Northern Iraq.
That's right.
You have the famine and refugees on the move in Ethiopia. You have Albanians crossing the ocean to get
to Italy.
To Italy. I wonder if you really knew what you were getting yourself into at that point.
I thought, well, my goodness, if this is the way it is, how would I survive, was really the kind of feeling I had in the beginning. But I was told that this was rather exceptional. There will be emergencies, and I had plenty, but not three in 1 week.
Let me turn to David Reif on this. David, you have been in almost all these places where Mrs. Ogata has worked with the UNHCR, working as a reporter and as a writer. Did something fundamental change in the 1990s when we saw civilians at the forefront of crises like this, rather than soldiers facing each other and civilians sort of as an afterthought in trouble?
Well, what's true is that the nature of the wars in which Madame Ogata played such an important and, I think, heroic role, in whatever our differences and disagreements, I wasn't entirely happy with your lead-in, which has me as her opponent, which I'm very much not. I think that what happened was that, if you like, what we came to call rather obscenely ethnic cleansing, excuse me, became the end state of so many of these wars. In other words, political victory for belligerents, say the Bosnian Serbs or the Rwandan Hutu, was the extermination and or expulsion of the enemy population. That made Madame Ogata's job central, because that meant that, in a sense, what the military called the end state of the war was the creation of a hideously large number of refugees. I think that's what changed in the nature of war. We have to be a little careful about saying that war went from killing soldiers to killing civilians. I would think that Madame Ogata, as a Japanese citizen, would have a problem with that, as do I, given what happened at the end of the Second World War. And in any case, the history of colonialism is, of course, also the history of killing civilians. So we have to be sort of careful on that side. But there's no doubt that ethnic cleansing became, I mean, I hate the word, but I don't know another one, became the sort of center of war making, at least in the wars that Madame Ogata had to cope with and that I tried to write about.
Mrs. Ogata, go ahead.
Yeah, the fact that ethnic issues were central meant that there was nobody who was really neutral, because you were by birth part of one ethnic group or the other. And it was this ethnic strife that made everybody part of the war, and also everybody part of the victim being victimized as well.
Did that mean that it was then hard for an agency like yours to find that a neutral position?
Well, what we tried to do was especially to don't take sides in the particular war, but anyway, whichever side were the more victimized, we had to be more helpful.
Let's if we can, go back to Sarajevo. I remember pictures from that time of you getting off the planes with your helmet and your vest on at the airport. You write about that as
yes.
a pretty memorable time for you.
Well, first, when we got the airlift going, we thought this was almost a solution of several weeks of that, and people in Sarajevo will be assured of being able to live. But also, we used to carry wheat to the central bakery. This was a big, big part of the assistance. But at the same time, the people felt that they were at least not forgotten, and it brought in enormous confidence and hope. But it was more complicated because Sarajevo was surrounded by the Serb forces around the mountains. And there, the Serb objective was to make that as difficult as possible to keep the airlift going into Sarajevo.
Which put you in a position of negotiating with Milosevic's people in order to allow convoys in, to allow planes in.
And also to make sure that we were not just benefiting one ethnic group, the Islam,
right.
The Muslims, who had a harder time. At the same time, even for medical evacuation, the Serbs would negotiate and say, if they're going to take three Muslims out, you have to take three Serb out for medical evacuation. And this kind of thing was very difficult. We had to recognize some parity, that we're not going to just help one ethnic group getting
right.
medical attention, but it had to be on a needs-based.
David, you were there at the time as well. Is there any way of delivering this kind of assistance that we're talking about without negotiating with the nasty people in the middle of a conflict, in effect becoming their carrot while the mortars and the cannons are their stick?
No, there's no way whatsoever, unless you have a military intervention that changes the equation on the battlefield. In other words, for an agency like UNHCR, for that matter, for a humanitarian relief NGO, for a group like Doctors Without Borders or mm-hmm. Oxfam or the International Rescue Committee, the job involves you, unless you are protected by some military force that in some sense is there to do your bidding. And that was very rare. There was such a force in Bosnia, but it had neither the mandate nor the will to act in the way I'm describing. Otherwise, what humanitarian relief work is about negotiating with murderers. That's unfortunately the reality of it. When Madame Ogata says the Serbs would insist on three evacuations to go along with the three from the government-controlled heart of the city, that means, in effect, that people who weren't as urgently in need of evacuation, since the lines, say, to Belgrade from the Serb-controlled areas were perfectly open, what the Serb besiegers of Sarajevo were doing is saying, we will not let you give aid to the people besieged in the center unless some of that aid comes to us. That's the quid pro quo. Absent a military intervention, I don't see what UNHCR could have done. I'm not at all critical of that. It seems to me that's the nature of what goes on.
And yet it became, I think, Mrs. Ogata, the longest humanitarian airlift in the century, didn't it? Six years?
Airlift, 3.5, I think.
Okay, right.
Until 96.
When you look
the
back
the airport
at
was closed after a certain moment.
Yes,
so from time to time. UNHCR had to truck things in over the mountains, which became even more
difficult. At the very end, yes. You see, the military, there are different functions that the military play. And in Bosnia, it was mostly the UN assigned peacekeeping forces to help humanitarian assistance. This was the mandate. And so this, in the beginning, our colleagues felt very uncomfortable being escorted by the peacekeeping forces were not combat forces.
Right.
They did not. But even so, to have military escorting truck convoys were very uncomfortable. At the same time, unless they were escorted, sometimes there would be a mine in front, bridges broken, even attacks from the sides and so on. So we could no longer deliver our own staff, the delivery, the convoys, nor the goods were not. So this is why gradually more assistance or coverage for humanitarian work. But as the war got worse and worse, then the question of airstrikes came in.
And we'll talk a little bit further about that when we come back. And in a broader sense, think back to all those pictures of all the different refugee crises over the 1990s and where that leaves us today. What do countries like the United States owe the world's refugees? Is it money? Is it assistance? Or is it a new home? 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Here with me in the studio, Sadako Ogata. She was the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees through the 1990s. She has a book about her time called The Turbulent Decade. She's currently president of the Japan International Cooperation Agency and living once again in Tokyo. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. David Reif is also with us. He's a journalist and a writer. He's a new book out called At the Point of a Gun, Democratic Dreams and Armed Intervention. He's also done a lot of work on humanitarianism. One of his other books is called A Bed for the Night, Humanitarianism in Crisis. David, let me, if I can, start with you on and jump ahead a few years, same part of the world, Kosovo, because that's a time when the U.S. and European countries were leading what they claimed was some kind of a humanitarian war. And that's where the words and the understanding of what's best for people gets very complicated.
Well, I would really, if I could go to my grave with the term humanitarian war having been expunged from the language, I think I would die about as happily as it's possible to die. It's the worst kind of euphemism and misnomer. A war is a war, and wars, even just wars, of course, as your listeners know and as we all know, are about the slaughter of innocents, even in a just cause. And they're brutalizing experiences even for people who are on the just side when and not every war has a just side. There is a just side. I think what happened in Kosovo was the effort by the great powers who had used humanitarian work in Bosnia, above all used UNHCR as a fig leaf. Madame Ogata writes about this in her book in I think, a very sensible and convincing way. In Kosovo, the idea was we wouldn't make those mistakes. We would have an effort, a war, as Prime Minister Blair said, of values, not interests, a situation in which the humanitarians would not be stuck, as it were, holding the fort while the rest of the world went about its business, the blood money, as you said in your intro. The problem was, from my perspective, that humanitarian efforts became subsumed to a war effort. And in effect, I think very much despite themselves, the relief world became a kind of subcontractor to the NATO. And that, for me, raises a lot of very troublesome issues. It was less troublesome in Kosovo than it would become in Afghanistan, say, where American bombers would quite literally drop bombs on one mission, and then the next mission would be a humanitarian aid drop. Or in Iraq, where briefers told us in the war, you'd go to a briefing and they say, well, we're clearing the road to Nasiriyah so we can bring up ammunition and humanitarian supplies. In other words, the confusions of roles, I think, really began to go haywire in Kosovo. At least that's the way I see it in retrospect. Unfortunately, I didn't understand that at the time, as clearly at least, and I'm not sure all that many people did, although perhaps a lot of people in the HCR may have.
What do you think, Ms.
Oh, I would agree with what David is saying. See, when the military, the same military, drops bombs and humanitarian assistance together and call that humanitarian war or humanitarian intervention, that is not quite correct. And I would have reservations, just as David has expressed. You see, the war in Kosovo at least had a very clear objective, and that was to force the withdrawal of Serb security forces. It did not decide, the war itself had not decided that Kosovo was to be independent or what. The political objectives was very unclear, and it's still unclear today. But the objective at that time was to force the Serb security forces out of Kosovo, because it was the Serb security forces that were really intimidating and not only intimidating, but wronging the people, attacking them and so. So that was the clear objective. And for that, in the beginning, there was negotiations repeatedly, and UNHCR was agreed upon by Milosevic to provide humanitarian assistance.
But once we're in a position, as David was leading us here, to a point where the people on the ground, the ordinary citizens, don't know if the plane flying over is going to drop bombs or food, and we saw this confusion in Afghanistan and in Iraq, as David said. I mean, has it reached a point now where the UN has lost its ability to claim a kind of neutrality?
Well, I think going back to Bosnia, for example, there was political negotiations going on all the time. I'm not saying that was effective enough, for the Americans didn't come in till rather late either. But it was during that period, on the one hand, the military was trying to stop the military intimidation against the ethnic cleansing and so on. Humanitarian was trying to do by being present and by bringing relief and so on, trying to prolong the survival potential of the people. But the overall objective was political at the end. And this, I think it should be the same in Kosovo too. But then the political objective got very blurred there. And the same military, while, of course, a lot of the refugees fled Kosovo after the military air action took place, not because of the air strike so much, but because the Serbs decided to expel them. It was forced expulsion of about 800,000 people.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We'd like to have you join us. We're taking a call from Burlington, Vermont. Ben's on the line. Hi, Ben.
Hi. First of all, I'd like to say that I really appreciate the contributions of both your guests. Then I'd like to point out that it's not necessarily a new thing, the objective of conflicts being ethnic cleansing, and I'm referring back to the Palestinian refugee problem from a long time ago, where it was definitely the objective of Israel, given Golda Meir's comment, you know, Palestinians, what Palestinians, to eradicate the even concept of Palestinians from the world. But my real question is the difference between those long protracted refugee problems, because there still is a Palestinian refugee problem. What's the difference in the challenges they face? It's not a new emerging crisis, but it's this long protracted crisis for the people who live there. And what's UNHCR doing for these folks? Thanks. I'll get off the line.
For Palestine, when UNHCR was established, it had mandate over all refugees in the world except those that were already under certain agencies' assistance and protection. And this is why we were not given Palestinian refugees as our objective of assistance and protection. Of course, if they're Palestinians outside the area, we did help. But it's one of the most protracted and most serious problems in the world. I agree. And I think the world has done so far is to try to give some assistance without really addressing the root causes.
I wonder, though, if I can go back to the point that we were at on this understanding the difference between humanitarian war, the use of that word and the humanitarian crisis, because it is always going to be to the advantage of an aggressor, whatever country that is, in whatever part of the world, to say, this is a humanitarian war. I wonder if the UN needs to work harder to say, no, you cannot use that word. You cannot use us as a cover. We're not going to be a part of this game. What do you think?
Well, UN and the Security Council as the central organ of peace and security matters in the United Nations, has to be active in addressing the root causes, political settlement, and you do have to negotiate with bad people and aggressors, and also represent the greatest people who are the greatest need. But I think these problems are political, military. It's about power.
And David, when the UN Security Council gets hung up on one nation's veto, then is it the UNHCR and agencies like this which are brought in to sort of paper over the difference?
Well, I don't think... No. I would put it a little bit differently. The UN has two important roles in terms of international operational action. The UN has many roles and many valuable roles, but one is peace and security, which was the premier role, and though that takes place principally in the Security Council context. And the other is the work of the specialized agencies, UNHCR and others. I think the UN is a tremendous, for all its faults, for all the scandals about peacekeeping in Congo, the oil for food business, the personal problems of unfortunate personal problems of Madame Ogata's successor. I actually think the specialized agencies do a brilliant job under impossible circumstances, and that, as if you like, an alleviation machine, the UN is essential and brilliant. I think it's a paralyzed instrument in terms of peace and security because of the Security Council structure. I might wish it otherwise, but I don't fundamentally think it works, because while we have an international community in name, we don't have an international community in terms of shared values. The UN is not a global government. It's an intergovernmental organization. And we've seen you started the program with talking about the expectations, asking Madame Ogata about the expectations of the post-Cold War world. We all shared this expectation that once the Cold War, the sort of heavy hand of the Cold War was removed, things would be better. In some ways they are, of course, but in other ways they're worse. And in terms of, I would argue at least, that the paralysis of the Security Council is as bad or worse today than it was in the Cold War period.
But Mrs. Ogata, yeah, when I made the point about the UNHCR then coming in to sort of paper over the differences there, you were shaking your head.
Well, I like the term alleviation machine that David just used. You see, the humanitarian agencies such as UNHCR or UNICEF and so on, we don't have to wait for the Security Council to move or do anything. We are there because we were set up for special work to do.
Right, but the Security Council doesn't have to do anything because they know that you're going to be there. Why the UNHCR has a budget of over $1 billion, because the U.S. and other countries, Japan among them, they can give a bunch of money to the UNHCR and say, see, we don't have to deal with the refugees.
But when the situation worsens to a point that you cannot just billions and billions of money is not going to stop the killings or stop the atrocities, then the Security Council has to work. And I think the humanitarian agencies used to keep quiet because we didn't want to get involved in politics. But at least if there's a machinery for peace and security, and also today, it's a globalizing world. One war in one place cannot be just disregarded. And this is in this globalizing world that I think the UN has to play some other role than just letting the alleviation machineries work. And I think there is that trend. And I hope the problems that are surfacing today I was also on the high-level panel on threats and approaches and change for the UN.
Right.
It is trying to really strengthen the political role of the UN, but has to be supported by the major powers.
1-800-423-8255 is our number. Let's go to Charlottesville, Virginia. And Abu is with us. Hello, Abu.
Hello. How are you doing?
I'm fine. Thanks for calling.
Hey, I'm very honored to talk to Mrs. Ogata. I've heard about you for a very, very long time.
Very nice.
I had you on the radio when I listened to BBC World Service. It's nice meeting you. I have something I want to discuss, actually, is the refugee status in Sierra Leone. And UNHCR...
Are you from Sierra Leone, Abu?
Yes, I am from Sierra Leone, and I'm presently in the United States. And it's a wonderful thing they're doing, actually, in Africa, especially for the war in my country. But at the same time, there are some pitfalls, because although there were enough money that was actually distributed to the government in Sierra Leone to help people, especially refugees, those money were not utilized the right way. Mm-hmm. I came to the United States after the war on my own, but there are people, my families, who did not have the opportunity to come, and they were refugees, and they told them that they were going to help them. In fact, what they did was they sent them to Ghana, and those people were in Ghana for almost a year without being finalized.
This is that temporary status position, Abu, that where people are sort of put in one place, asked to stay there for a time, assuming that they'll be able to go home?
No, they put them there with the hope that they're going to bring them to the United States, which is much better. And that was the pretext. And they sent them to Ghana for some time, and when they went to Ghana and nothing was done about it, they just dumped them there. And those people were fending for themselves.
Who let them down then, Abu? Was it the United Nations, or was it countries like the United States which are taking fewer refugees these days?
Well, not exactly, because the reason was because United Nations, UNHCR, actually gets some people in Sierra Leone who are Sierra Leoneans to do this job. And those people used the money for themselves and ended up dumping these people in different places instead of sending them to the places where they're expected to go. And this has always been the norm. People who are actually supposed to have the help are not having the help. Instead, the money is going back to the pocket of people who are actually not refugees. And this is what
let's hear from Mrs. Ogata on this.
You see, I think I would argue against your comment that this was the norm. No, I'm not saying that there's no abuses anywhere. I mean, there are abuses from time to time, and my work was really to make sure that the abuses were not taking place and so on. But at the same time, you see, I know Sierra Leone, right now it is possible for people to go back to Sierra Leone, and there are some development work that even my JICA, the Japanese aid agency, has set up an office to try to help that country go through rehabilitation now. So, but you see, when there are refugees, and Sierra Leone really had suffered a great deal, I do know that. You see, there are several ways of solving their problems. One is, if their home country is good enough, they can always go back, but that takes a long time. Sometimes they will be given a chance to become part of the country that received them temporarily, and that is also another way. But a third part country, and this is what means that has been discussed, is resettling to another country. Mm-hmm. And, of course, a country like the United States. In Europe, it was a lot Germany. These were the places where a lot of people wanted to be resettled. But there is a ceiling on the part of the United States or Germany of receiving all these people. And this is where the real difficulty came, because there are more people wanting to be resettled in the U.S. than the U.S. was ready to receive.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Abu, quickly back to you. Do you think that the U.S. needs to take more refugees, or are you just arguing for a fairer system administered by the UN?
Well, I'm arguing for both. I think United States needs to do more to take more refugees. I think the number of people they are taking, especially in Africa, what they have to realize is Africa is a third world country. Africa is not at some of these countries in Europe, which is much better than Africa economically. But America needs to put more effort and receive more refugees. I know they are doing very well, because a very good friend of mine who is in nursing school here in the United States was here as a refugee, and his whole family, his mother, sisters, his kids and everybody, they are all here. They are doing pretty good. Okay, America is doing a great job, but I think it's just not enough.
Abu, I need to stop you right there. We're going to take a short break. We'll come back and continue the conversation after that. Some 17 million people who are claiming refugee status or displaced or asylum seekers in the world. The United States planning on taking about 40,000 refugees this year. The numbers are up and in some countries, but down in most. And is that a problem that we need to be talking about? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. What is the best way to help refugees? Do we take the guidance of the UNHCR? Is that a system which has proven itself? Or are circumstances in the world changing such that we need to look at other options? Sadako Ogata is with me. She was the UN High Commissioner for Refugees through the 1990s, and her new book about that time is called The Turbulent Decade. David Reif is with us. He's a journalist and a writer. His new book's called At the Point of a Gun, Democratic Dreams and Armed Intervention. If you'd like to join us, our number's 1-800-423-8255. David, I haven't had a chance to turn to you in a couple of moments just on this whole point of warehousing. Is it real? Is it realistic to say that the systems in place right now allow wealthy countries like the U.S. to say, here's some money, deal with it so we don't have to?
No. There are many things to reproach the United States for, in my view, not least the recent nomination for the ambassador to the United Nations, which is certainly going to make all the questions, in my view, that Madam Ogata and I have been talking about on your program more difficult. But I really don't think it's fair to describe the problems of migration simply in terms of warehousing. Look, we live in an era of worldwide migration. It's one of the great migrations in world history of people from the global south to the global north. Refugees are one particularly tragic and difficult and important part of this subject. But there are a number of others, not least simply what we call illegal migration, that is to say, or undocumented migration. This is taking place everywhere from the poor world to the rich world. Indeed, it's also taking place, it takes place within even the poor world, from relatively poorer places to richer places. Ivory Coast is a good example of this phenomenon. Madam Ogata knows it well. You can't simply talk about the 40,000 number when you have, for example, an effective mass migration across the southern borders of the United States. This is a much bigger phenomenon. On the other side, and something we haven't talked about, I know that something that gives people in UNHCR fits because none of us know how to deal with this problem, is the problem of people who are not displaced across an international boundary and therefore attain, if that's the right word, refugee status, but people inside boundaries of countries where there's ethnic war, environmental breakdown, and the environmental issue is a very important one. And sometimes we get wars are more picturesque events in a certain sense, but environmental breakdown causes as many of the gravest problems we face. Those are the so-called IDPs, internally displaced people. This is one of the great events, I think largely tragic events, but events of our time, of the late 20th and early 21st centuries. It's crucially important to talk about refugee crises, but there's a lot more to it than that.
1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Canton, New York. Brad's on the line from there. Hi, Brad.
Hi. Thank you to David and the Madam High Commissioner. I lived for a number of years in West Africa in the early 60s in the Ivory Coast and Sierra Leone and Guinea. And I agree it's more of a refugee problem than you're talking about. And I'm concerned, as David related, of our new appointed ambassador, Mr. Bolton, who's really an anti-internationalist, anti-UN person. Wouldn't this put the U.S. position a whole cocked hat as it relates to whether it's food or refugees or votes in the U.N. or any kind of international help through the U.S.? Isn't this a political and a power question, as the Madam High Commissioner suggested?
Ms. Ogata, you have known John Bolton for years.
Yeah, well, we've had some dealings with him over the Sarajevo airlift and so on. He gets things done. And let's hope that this aspect of his very strong character will come out in the various dealings with the U.N. I am not about to say who is a good representative, who is not a representative. That is up to the country, the government, to really decide. At the same time, let's hope that the things he will come in strongly and get things done for not only the U.S., but for everybody.
You must be worried, though, at any indication that a country as powerful as the United States would take it upon itself to say, we can solve this crisis, rather than taking whatever crisis that is to the UN and trying to work at it with partnerships. I mean, that must trouble you. That's a trend that we've seen.
Sure. I have worked with the United States for very closely on various things. But one thing I can say for certain, no strong country, even the strongest country, can solve all the world's problems all by itself. That is for certain. And this is why UN needs the U.S., U.S. needs the UN. That's my very strong conviction.
Brad, are you still there?
Yes.
Do you think that someone like John Bolton, who has claimed that really there only ought to be just one member of the Security Council, and that would be the USA, can be shifted, can be turned to looking at how to work within a system like that?
Well, it sounds like the Madam High Commissioner has some experience working with him, and maybe somebody as extreme as he is can come. You know, they say sometimes the lion chases his own tail, and maybe he'll come around. Maybe he's the kind of person who can be turned around. We've seen this in civil rights. We've seen this in many aspects in the Middle East right today. People have been turned around. So maybe, you know, and I hadn't looked at it this way because I was quite upset when Bolton was appointed because he didn't seem to be somebody who's going to work in tandem with and helpful to our role in the United Nations when we're trying to do some helpful things now, and all of a sudden we have this person who seems like an obstructionist. But you know, maybe you're right. Let's give him a chance.
What do you think, David?
Well, love the sinner, hate the sin, I suppose, is the answer to that question. I certainly hope that it's Earl Warren about civil rights, as the gentleman alludes to, or Nixon in China, but I'm pessimistic. At the UN, the joke, the in-house joke, is a Bolton from the blue. And look, the United States is in a period of feeling that it really has right on its side. And I think the appointments and the policies reflect that. However, sooner or later, Washington is going to discover the truth of what Madam Ogata said earlier. I just hope it will be sooner.
Sooner, yes, I do too.
Yeah. It's 1-800-423-8255 to Wellesley, Massachusetts, and Edith is with us. Hello, Edith.
Hello.
Thanks for calling. What are you thinking?
Today? Well, I just returned as part of a small group from the Conference of Catholic Bishops Office for Refugee Resettlement and Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Services Resettlement Office to Malaysia and Thailand, where we were visiting a number of situations where many tens of thousands of Burmese people have been relocated for some serious issues that are going on in Burma and have been displaced for upwards of 20 years. And the way in which the UNHCR is dealing with the situation, and this is a very complex situation, not simple at all, really also falls to how each individual country recognizes and is willing to deal with those people in their countries. And in Malaysia, the UNHCR office really was inadequately staffed to do the processing work because those countries who are either open to resettlement or certainly looking for a permanent solution for these people is reliant on UNHCR to make determinations.
Was it your view, Edith, that the UNHCR could do a better job if it had more people, or that its mandate is so complicated and in many ways so confused by its different offices that that's what's holding up its assistance towards refugees?
I think it's both. I think they need more resources, but they need to recognize the situation in spite of whether or not other countries say they have a problem. In Thailand...
Which brings us back to what we were talking about, operating independently of countries.
They have to act in concert with countries. As an example, in Thailand, the Thailand government has recognized that they have a large number of refugees and is looking to UNHCR to process them, and there are resources there being put into place to do that. In Malaysia, the Malaysia government says, we have no refugees, but in truth, they have tens of thousands of refugees, and UNHCR doesn't have nearly the number of resources in place. They're just beginning to gear up in Malaysia to deal with these refugees, and there are tens of thousands of them living in the jungle who are
Let's hear from Mrs. Ogata on this, because you're in a position of being able to look back at all these kinds of experiences that you dealt with. Is there a better way of operating?
Well, you see, I'm the Burmese refugees. This was a big issue during my time, and I know what we did. I mean, there were about 230,000 Burmese refugees from the western part, Rakhine states, who went to Bangladesh. Bangladesh, being a very poor country, said we cannot keep them, and they were going to expel. So UNHCR did negotiate, and at least by claiming a UNHCR presence in within Burma, especially in the western coastal states, some 210,000 have come back. They're not in the ideal situation, but they have gone back, and they are still starting to work. Now, I think the issue that has been raised is on the eastern shore side of Burma, from which refugees have gone into Thailand, and I don't think that part is settled. UNHCR was negotiating very much with the Burmese government so that there will be some possibility of return with the international presence, UNHCR, CRS, and so on. I don't know how fast that is moving,
part of it that always gets me, and I'm sorry if I bring such a naive perspective to it, but here's the UNHCR negotiating with the military junta in Myanmar, Burma, and those people, it's like you don't want to sit across the table from them. Do you know what I mean? Look what they've done to the people in that country.
There are serious problems, but they are careful. If UNHCR is there with the returning refugees or those who are, they are careful. And this is all you can do. I mean, you cannot make saints out of everybody, you know? And I think this question about these are bad people who don't want to negotiate, who negotiates on behalf of the people who are threatened or weak? And this is it's a tough job. But I think there are refugees and problems still in Southeast Asia, but the big Indochina refugee issues are more or less over, and there are still cases. That I agree. And I'm not saying anywhere it's perfect.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Where are we going next? To Louisville, Kentucky. Harold's on the line. Hi, Harold.
Hello there.
Thanks for calling. What do you think?
Well, I've got a comment, and I guess I wish I could phrase it as a question, but I really can't, so I'll just state it, and we'll see what happens. I've had the impression that Bolton's appointment means that the administration is taking the UN really quite seriously and hopes to make some good things happen with it. The fact that you appoint someone with a strong position, whether it be considered really positive or really negative, it seems to me means that you expect something to happen, presumably something good. If the UN were not taken seriously by the United States, by the administration, I think we would have had an appointment much more like some of our classic ambassadorial positions where people go in as political favors and they just sit there and don't do much.
Maybe, Ms. Ogata, it's good to send someone in who doesn't speak the language of the Security Council.
Well, I don't know. I'll be just very eager to watch what happens with Mr. Bolton in the United Nations.
David, a comment?
Well, I'm afraid I belong more to the, it's like making Dracula head of the blood bank school of thought on this matter. I don't really understand the gentleman's point, with all due respect, because, if you appoint someone who doesn't believe in global warming to be head of the Environmental Protection Agency, you could say you take environmental protection seriously? And that good things will happen? I don't think you would. I think you'd say that you're showing your contempt for the science behind global warming. My own view is that Bolton's a man who says there should be, the actual quote about the Security Council is there should be only one permanent veto-wielding member of the United States. That doesn't augur well. Again, I hope, the road to Damascus process is the one that obtains, but I'm not holding my breath.
I wonder, Mrs. Ogata, if I can take you back to a quote that has often followed you around. There are no humanitarian solutions to humanitarian problems. Some people choose to interpret that some way, but your interpretation of it is that there are or should be political solutions to these rather than simply relief and aid solutions. Are we any closer to a system that puts that into practice, or do you think maybe that we are as far away from today as we were when you began this work 15 years ago?
Well, I hope, you see, the United Nations was set up as an interstate or intergovernmental organization. So the peace and security issues were always wars between states. And this is how the Security Council was set up in dealing with the peace and security issues. And then during the 90s, what happened was there were a lot of internal wars. And then there was not enough instruments or whatever, ways to get into internal wars in a very clear way, because sovereign states insisted that they were not to be interfered, but de facto, in a globalizing world, there is no such thing as sovereignty protecting every person in the country. So in that sense, there are certain inroads into it. And in that sense, I think the question of what I meant by political has to be humanitarian problems had to be solved politically is just stating the reality, because people are suffering from political injustice, domination, and even violation of human rights and wars.
So is the further reality, though, that the UN then needs a more robust peacemaking or peacekeeping team to work with its agencies? So
sure.
People like those who work with the UNHCR don't have to go in next to the Americans or next to some particular nation and then seem to be too close to them.
Well, Americans or whatever nation, there's a clear mandate that they're doing this for everybody else, not just for your own country, I wouldn't mind working. Excellent American forces have been there at sometimes, and sometimes they're much too close to the interests of their own countries. So in that sense, I think UN does have a good, neutralizing or universalizing mechanism.
Well, you're clearly very engaged with it still, even though you're out of the office.
Right.
It's nice to have you here. Thank you so
Thank
much
you
for coming
much.
In. Sadako Ogata, former UN High Commissioner for Refugees, and David Reif, thank you for being with us.
Thank you. Pleasure.
David is a journalist and an author, most recently of At the Point of a Gun, Democratic Dreams and Armed Intervention. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.